Hello all, it's been a while since my last episode, and this was mostly due to just everything becoming too much to handle all at once, but I've got a good plan in place to keep the episodes coming at a consistent basis. Right now, the plan is for me to work on episodes every weekend, and new episodes will be released every 2 weeks. I think this is a good schedule because I don't think this show works well for a weekly format, since the aim is for me to take a deep dive on these various games. The quality was not where I wanted it in previous episodes, so I wanted to give myself some more time to work on them. I do want to do other things for my YouTube channel, however, that could fill the gaps between memory card episodes, so keep an eye out on my YouTube channel. I might have some new things come out that I'm currently kind of brainstorming right now. But for now, just look forward to new memory card episodes every 2 weeks. And with that, let's get to the fifth episode of this series for the podcast version. As always, you can watch the YouTube version on my YouTube channel, Gamma Galaxian, where we have it's a video format. So if you enjoy more of a visual format, then that is your cup of tea. But feel free to stick around for this episode of the podcast. In the early days of video games, mainframe computers were amongst the primary ways that video games were developed, and we've already covered several mainframe games, including Hammurabi, Marion Bad, The Sumerian Game, and Star Trek 1971. However, there are a few more mainframe games that I wanted to touch on. So I decided to group these games all together because they may not otherwise have enough of content to warrant their own episodes, but they still deserve to be talked about on the show as they were essential in the early days of video games. So today we talk about Hunt the Wumpus, Empire, and Colossal Cave Adventures. As always, welcome to Memory Card, the history of video games, a series where we take a chronological look at video game history under a microscope lens. I'm not just here to talk about video games from the past, but also to look at how they were made and who made them. I also take a look at other historical events in video game history and the influential people within the gaming industry. So welcome to Memory Card, the history of video games, the podcast version. And today we look at some mainframe games. As always, there's a little bit of difference between the podcast version and the YouTube version. The podcast version is more casual. I'm kind of trying to have more of a conversation with the audience as opposed to the YouTube version, which is more in line with a docuseries style. So yeah, feel free to sit back and enjoy. So we begin with Hunt the Wumpus. It's first up on our list today, and much like the games we've discussed and the games around this time, it is a text-based game, or at least it started out that way. It was created by Gregory Yaub, I'm hoping I pronounced that correctly, in 1973, and the game is often regarded as the first survival horror video game, long before the days of Resident Evil and Silent Hill. Yaub was inspired by the games published in the People's Computer Company, and he wanted to make a game that was different than the standard 10x10 grid at the time. He wanted a game that did not use a grid at all. He came up with the Wumpus monster and the idea of the player traversing through rooms in a cave with the monster hiding in one of those rooms. I cannot pronounce this next word, so bear with me. So Yaub went with the layout of what is called a dodecahedron, it's some kind of shape, which had a total of 20 rooms, according to one of the maps that I researched on the game. So Yaub actually numbered the cave systems as he predicted that players would want to make maps of the game for, you know, different strategies and stuff like that. Originally, the Wumpus did not move, and Yaub found it pretty boring, so he made the Wumpus able to move, and after that, he sent a copy written in BASIC to People's Computer Company. Later that year, Yaub went to a conference at Stanford University, and much to his surprise, many of the people there were playing his game. Even later that year, People's Computer Company published the game in its November 1973 issue. There are several versions of Hunt the Wumpus, and Yaub made sequels called Wumpus 2 and Wumpus 3. The second game had a different arrangement for the caves, and the third game added more hazards. One of the versions that was written in the C computer language can be found on modern BSD and Linux operating systems today in the BSD games package. In terms of gameplay, it is rather simple since it is text-based. There are 20 rooms or caves, and in one of the caves is the titular monster. However, there are other hazards, as two of the caves contain bottomless pits, and another two contain what are called super bats. The super bats pick up the player and move them to a random cave. Each cave is connected to three other caves. The game is turn-based, and each turn starts by telling the player which cave they are currently in. The player has a few options on each turn, including moving to a new cave or shooting a crooked arrow. The player only has 5 of these arrows, so they may have to be very selective about firing these. In terms of the setting, the player is immersed in complete darkness, and the game states that the player can smell a wumpus, hear a bat, or feel a draft from a pit in one of the 3 connected caves. If the player enters a cave with a pit, that's game over. If the player enters a cave with the wumpus will either move to a new cave or stay to kill the player. If the player decides to fire a crooked arrow, the player decides which caves it will fly through, with a selection of up to 5. The arrow can also hit the player in the game. But the arrow can also hit the wumpus, which is how you win. And if it doesn't hit anything, then the wumpus will move to a new cave. If the wumpus ever moves to a cave the player is in, that's game over. Hopefully I did an okay job explaining that. Hopefully that made sense. So there's not too much to the game beyond that, though, but it does sound like a lot of fun in hunting the wumpus with the additional hazards. Yob was definitely thinking beyond the grid formula for games around this time, and truly wanted to make something that was different. In just describing the game, it really does feel like he accomplished this, and I think it is awesome that through my research on this through doing memory card that I was able to find probably one of the first survival horror games, because survival horror games is something that I like to play. I love Resident Evil. I haven't really played Silent Hill that much, but I'm definitely going to try and get into Silent Hill. But I love the survival horror stuff. So it's really cool to kind of see where that kind of started in terms of gaming history. And, I don't know if there was something before Hunt the Wumpus that counts as that, but Hunt the Wumpus seems like that is the first survival horror video game. So now we move on to Empire. So Empire came out in 1977, and it was created by Walter Bright. So as a child, he was fascinated with games like Risk, Stratego, and the film Battle of Britain. He created a board game based on all of these, and further down the line, he decided that a computer could do the gameplay. The first version of Empire was written in BASIC. However, in 1977, it was rewritten in Fortran for the PDB-10 computer at Caltech. The game became a sensation on other PDB-10 computers, and Bright later recoded the game in assembly language. It was made available commercially, but only sold 2 copies. Then, and this is kind of where it gets a little bit interesting, then the unexpected happened. Someone broke through the security systems at Caltech and stole the source code for the game. The code, after that point, kind of jumped around before eventually being found on a computer in Massachusetts by Herb Jacobs and Dave Minton. They then ported the game for the VAC/VMS operating system. The game was submitted to DECUS, I believe it's pronounced. It's D-E-C-U-S, DECUS, which its programs often were a part of the initial games installed on DEC computers. Thus, Empire continued to spread through that. When Bright caught wind of this, he contacted DECUS in 1983, and they actually gave Bright credit for the game in the catalog description. And he was added back into the source code. So it was, actually a happy ending for Bright, which, in terms of, you don't often see a happy ending for things like this. Happy ending for Bright. And definitely glad that, you know, they were able to, you know, give him the proper credit, especially after this all started from a break-in. Through my research, I didn't see if they ever found who did the break-in or anything like that. So if anybody has any information about that, I would definitely be interested in, if anybody has any info on that, that'd be also pretty interesting, to look at. So the game continued to have different versions made throughout the 80s. At the same time as these other versions, Bright was working on his own as he ported it to an IBM PC. He wrote several software companies in order to get the game commercially sold, but it was Interstell who bought. Mark Baldwin co-authored the game and redesigned it. The game, now called Empire War Game of the Century, was made available on the Atari ST, Amiga, Commodore 64, Apple II, Macintosh, and DOS. In the early 90s, Mark Baldwin and Bob Rakowski rewrote the game again, this time dubbing it Empire Deluxe. Excuse me. This version was made available for DOS, macOS, and Windows. The game also featured an expansion pack called Empire Deluxe Scenarios in 1993, which added a map and a scenario statistics tool, a map randomizer tool, patches for the DOS and Windows versions, and 37 different scenarios. So there was also a sequel, which was named Empire II: The Art of War, published by New World Computing, and was playable on DOS and Windows. So that's where the complicated history of Empire ends. Bright originally created the game, and as time went on, the game changed several hands before it landed into Mark Baldwin's, who continued its commercial success in the 90s. In 1996, Computer Gaming World said the original Empire created by Bright was the 8th best computer game ever released and the 2nd best computer war game released by 1996, setting behind Panzer General. That is really high marks. And the game was immensely popular, and there are even modern ports for current PC operating systems on Walter Bright's Classic Empire webpage. Sid Meier, who created the Civilization series, has said Empire was a big inspiration for his own video game series that hopefully we get to touch on a much later episode. So with the history out of the way, let's talk about the gameplay. And the gameplay is honestly pretty similar to a lot of like war game strategy games today. So each game starts with a random map and is laid out on a grid. The map consists of islands, a random distribution of cities, and the players start controlling one of these cities each. The area around the city is visible, but the overall map is blacked out, which is a common gameplay mechanic in Grand War strategy games today. Cities can be used to build armies, aircraft, and ships. Each take a certain number of turns to produce these units and armies, and armies are usually the quickest. Players can move their units on the map to explore the map. Other cities can be discovered and captured by the players' armies. The overall goal of the game is to completely conquer the map and capture the other players' territories. It's much in the same vein as Risk, but instead of a roll of the dice, it is a computer doing the work. And it is much in the same vein as a lot of Grand War strategy games as well. The one that's popping into my head is like Age of History 2. It's kind of in the same vein of whoever rules the entire map wins the game, basically. So, but that's pretty much it for Empire. It had such a complicated history for such a simple game. I'm glad that Bright was, again, able to get that credit he deserved for creating such a game that was hugely influential to war strategy games, even to today. So the last one on our list today is Colossal Cave Adventures. And you may not have heard of this game in particular, but you have probably heard of Adventure for the Atari 2600. And Colossal Cave Adventure directly inspired that game. And we're going to get into pretty much how. So Colossal Cave Adventures was created by William Crowther in the 70s. William and his wife Patricia were cave explorers and programmers. They had explored the Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, which is known as the longest cave system in the world. Alongside their caving expeditions, they produced vector map surveys of the caves. A teleprinter then sent and printed these maps and was connected to a PDP-1 mainframe computer. The data was then inserted into a program that was developed by both William and Patricia that generated plotting commands onto punch tape. This punch tape was then inputted into a Honeywell 316 mini computer attached to a CalComp drum plotter at Bolt, Baranek, and Newman to print paper maps. There were several. There were some of the earliest computer-drawn maps of caves. However, the two did divorce, and William stopped going on caving expeditions. Eventually, he did work on a text-based game in the Fortran programming language for a PDP-10 mainframe computer, which interfaced with a teleprinter. He was inspired by his time surveying caves, such as the Mammoth Cave system, and the 1975 maps of the Bedquilt area of caves, which included Colossal Cavern. He also liked Dungeons and Dragons and decided to design a game that focused on exploring caves for treasure. One of his primary goals was accessibility, so that those that weren't caught up on the technology could also play it. So he developed a natural language input system to control the game, which he said, quote, gave the illusion anyway that you'd type in English commands, and it did what you said. So once the game was completed, he showed it to his coworkers at BBN, and he essentially thought he was done with it. Well, while he was on vacation, the game spread amongst the ARPANET network and was being played at other companies and universities. One of the many people that played the game was Don Woods, who played it at Stanford University. After contacting William for the source code, he added onto the game to include a lot of fantasy elements, including a dragon, more puzzles, and a pirate. This new version also included a scoring system and more opportunities to collect treasure. Woods continued releasing updated versions of the game all the way up to 1995. Much like other games at this time, several different versions floated around after its release, and there were so many versions that an article in Your Computer dubbed them adventure games, and there was an adventure writing kit program for the ZX81 computer that could be used to generate a game with the similar aspects of gameplay. In 2007, Eric S. Raymond released a port of Woods' 1995 version to create Open Adventure and release the source code under an open source license. Commercially, the game was released by Microsoft as Microsoft Adventure in 1979 for the Apple II Plus and TRS-80 computers, and eventually MS-DOS for IBM PCs. The original Adventure was released by Software Toolworks, and it is the only version which Crowther and Woods received money for. Level 9 Computing released several versions as Colossal Adventure for the NASCOM. Most recently, there was a 3D remake called Colossal Cave released by Cygnus Entertainment for Windows, macOS, Linux, Nintendo Switch, PS5, Series X, and MetaQuest 2. It was designed by Ken and Roberta Williams, and Roberta stated that the game was meant to be a recreation of how she felt playing the original game in 1979. Arguably, Colossal Cave Adventure is considered to be one of the most influential video games in history. It was recently inducted into the World Video Game Hall of Fame in 2019. It was influential in how adventure fiction games were developed. Historian Alexander Smith also stated that alongside Star Trek and Lunar Lander, the game was essentially on every computer. The game would also go on to inspire other games such as Zork, Adventureland, Mystery House, and eventually Adventure for the Atari 2600. But we could talk about the history and the influential nature of Colossal Cave Adventure for hours, so let's get on to the gameplay aspects. So like other games, this is a text-based game, and the player explores a cave that contains treasure. There are several puzzles within the cave that the player has to solve to progress. Solving these puzzles includes using items that are found while exploring. The player uses one or two word commands to move through the cave and interact with objects. Each room within the cave has a name associated with it, along with a description and items or puzzles it has. The narrator, aka the program, acts in the same way as a dungeon master for a tabletop game, and responds in a more human-like way, providing a conversational experience. Crowther's version of the game, which we'll primarily talk about, had five treasures in total. Crowther's version of the game, which we'll primarily talk about, had five treasures in total within the cave. We did it. We got through it. The layout of the map was based on a real cave system, but the fantasy elements also included are a crystal bridge, magic boards, and dwarves. The dwarves are an enemy in the game that can kill the player, but the player can also die by falling into a pit. As stated, Woods' version added 10 more treasures to the game, more fantasy elements, and a point system. The goal changed from not just finding treasure, but reaching the maximum number of points, which was 350 in the 1977 version. And that wraps up the mainframe games. I really want to discuss that. I cannot talk again. I am not going through this script very well. And that wraps up the mainframe games. All three of these games have such an interesting history, and they all influence the rest of gaming history in some form or fashion. In a way, we took a look at the pioneering games for several genres, including survival horror, grand strategy, and adventure. These games played a pivotal role in how gaming history played out, and I hope you learned as much as I did about these games. So on the next episode, we'll take a look at several Play-Doh games. Play-Doh was a computer system that has its fair share of influential games as well. And I'm very excited about that. I've already begun writing that episode, and there's a lot of really cool, interesting stuff in that. So yeah, see you then. As always, please go check out the sources that I'm going to list here in a minute. Without these sources, there would be no episodes, so definitely go read more into these stories that I've talked about. I always just touch the surface because I have a limited amount of time, but there's so much to go beyond what I just talked about. As I said, I could spend an eternity talking about what games were inspired by Colossal Cave Adventure and how many different versions there were. I really enjoyed this episode because I got to learn about some games that I didn't know existed, but had a direct impact on some of the games that I've played. It is fascinating to learn the games that pioneered what we gamers enjoy today. So as for the sources, I definitely relied on Wikipedia a lot in this episode. In terms of like articles and stuff like that, I couldn't really find too much that was separated from Wikipedia. So definitely I would start with Wikipedia and kind of go from there. But History of Information also has some good info as well. And yeah, that's going to be it. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and see you in a couple weeks.